Okay, great. All right, so it is Tuesday, May 19th, 2026. And I was just sort of talking about trying to stay sane in a world that tests us at every turn. And just was going to say that the way that I these days, the way I finish my morning sitting after I ring my bell for myself, I just say, I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And when I say that to myself, I just try to think about, kind of being sane. How can I be sane today? What can I do? And I'm not talking about clinical insanity. I'm talking about just the challenge of living in the world, which, I think there's a tendency to think that the time we live in is more difficult than other times, but I'm not sure that's necessarily true. I guess I don't believe that. I think that being a human being on this planet comes with a whole bunch of inherent difficulties, and then human beings themselves tend to, create a bunch of other difficulties that might not really be necessary. I would give war as one example of that. Like, it's hard enough to just survive, but then people decide they should try to all kill each other. So, on that happy, cheerful note, sorry. I was thinking about the term rabbit holes. I mentioned this a couple months ago in a Dharma talk, and how people talk about going down rabbit holes. And then I heard a reference to Alice in Wonderland, and made me wonder if that was where we started using that expression, going down rabbit holes. But I've, my counter narrative is that we're really giving rabbits a bad name. I don't think we should blame our problems on rabbits and their holes. In fact, I think going down a rabbit hole might be a very nice thing to do. Just go down in there, snuggle up with a cuddly rabbit, be warm and quiet, So I'm trying to, recast rabbit holes as being okay. And there are wholesome rabbit holes. Wow, that's really a strange phrase. Wholesome holes. Okay, we're going to get serious now. I don't want anybody to think this isn't a very serious gathering. Here we're here to. What are we here to do? Nobody knows. We're going to meditate though, and then we'll try to figure it all out. So I will do some guided instruction, and then I'll leave some quiet time. So this will be about 20 minutes. So just settling into a posture that is supportive of your practice. So if you're not used to meditating, it's recommended that we sit upright, although it's okay to lie down if that's needed for taking care of the body. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Essentially, we are moving out of the visual world, turning the attention inward. Beginning simply by feeling your body, how it's feeling this morning or at this moment. So there might be particular sensations worth noting, or an energetic state, sleepiness or restlessness. And the subtler sensations in the body. These we can start to become more aware of as the awareness becomes more subtle. And call the experience of the body, feeling it as a field of energy. So it isn't so much parts or elements of a body, but just a flow, an ongoing flow of energy. And particularly with the eyes closed, not sort of looking at the parts of our body, the hands and arms and legs, but just feeling. Oh, however you're experiencing your body, bringing some awareness to that. And then bringing forward in awareness the sensations of breath. You can feel the breath as the air touching at the nostrils coming in and out. We're feeling it as movement in the abdomen, the solar plexus, chest. The breath is a rhythmic, changing movement. Subtle. So the mind isn't necessarily attracted to the breath the way it is to something more dramatic, entertaining. So it can take a little extra effort to, first of all, just to feel and be aware of the breath, and then to develop an interest that you can stay with it for any sustained period. Thoughts tend to pull our attention away, even when we're aware of the breath. Thoughts may be drifting through. So we don't demonize thoughts. Just that when we notice unhelpful thoughts, we come back to the breath. Restart that awareness, that connection. If the mind is kind of drifty, having a hard time stabilizing, see if you can come in more closely to the sensations of breath. Feel the touch of air moving in, out. The subtle sensations, rather than just being aware of in and out, we start to track the whole length of the breath. Not straining or grasping at the breath, to just kind of moving in close. And you don't have to stay that close, but just make a good connection so that you're very clear on what the breath feels like. And see if you can relax with that. Along with this mindfulness of the breath, we bring in a gentleness. It's an underlying kindness that we are caring for ourselves in this little period of time. Rather than thinking of our meditation as something to get good at or to do right, I think of it as a time of caretaking. Like having a healthy meal or doing some exercise or rest, something we do to take care of ourselves. In this case, particularly taking care of our mind and our heart. So there's no struggle, no climbing to attain something. I was just thinking, I mentioned the taking refuge, that that's what we're doing here when we take refuge in the Buddha, is, being committed to being present. And we come here to practice, in a sense, to practice being present. Taking refuge in the Dharma is to look at things through the lens of Dharma, and that's certainly what we do here, reflect on Dharma and recovery, and then the Sangha is our community. So here we are manifesting that very thing. So I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned it on the recording, but that I would look at a sutta this morning. And this is the sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya. We'll put some texts in here in the chat. Majjhima Nikaya, which means middle length discourses. This is MN for Majjhima Nikaya 19, Two Kinds of Thought. There we go. And it's, one of the suttas that's used a lot in teaching meditation, and very, very commonly shared. And there's a particular line in here that many of you will recognize. But like any great spiritual text, the suttas of the Pali Canon, live, you learn more every time you look. You always see something new. Or let's at least say, well, you often see something new. They are quite rich and layered. And I'll say, one of the things that's occurred to me recently is we read these, and they are not written in a kind of, they don't sound like ordinary English language. This version is from the great translator Bhikkhu Bodhi. And as I think about one of the reasons why these are difficult to understand, I think that Bhikkhu Bodhi is striving primarily for linguistic accuracy and trying to find the words that exactly capture what the Pali terms mean in as as close to as we can get to them in English, which is in and of itself tricky, because Pali is an ancient dead language, not spoken anymore. And the teachings were given by a meditative adept who, we can see, has experiences. His mind is beyond what most of us are capable of, and so it creates layers of difficulties in translation and in our understanding. So as I say, I think Bhikkhu Bodhi is most interested in linguistic accuracy rather than helping us to, like, practice. That's kind of the job of the, I guess, the interpreters of the translation, or the teachers, and for each of us to reflect on these and try to see what we can derive from them. And ultimately, the way I think of learning through the suttas is that we have to practice and then try to make some correlation between our experience, our meditative experience particularly, as well as our broader life experience, but particularly our meditative experience, which is a nonverbal one, and make some correlation with the language and the words of the suttas. And that means that each of us is going to have, in some sense, our own translation, our own understanding of this. So with all that, let me go through some of the high points of this sutta. That's a sutta that we could spend hours on, certainly, but we don't have that much time this morning. So, as with most of the suttas, we're introduced to where the Buddha is in Jetta's Grove and not Pentecost Park, and Ananda is reciting this, and this is and the Buddha starts out by saying this. Before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, somebody on the path, it occurred to me, suppose I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. So this is a really, one of those kind of really useful instructions the Buddha gives in terms of watching your own mind. I thought, let me just notice when I'm having an unwholesome thought and when I'm having a wholesome thought. It's not exactly mindfulness 101, but somewhat. It's very much like what I think how we come to understand what we're doing in meditation. One of the primary things we're trying to do is, notice my thoughts and notice what they're, if they're useful or they're, I don't know, destructive in some way. And then he says, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, which is a kind of key phrase through the suttas, and I might get into it, but let me get into the heart of this. A thought of sensual desire arose in me, and I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me, so I see it. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, to the affliction of both. It's not a helpful thought. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana. So what we can see is that not, he's not just seeing the thought, but he's seeing what the result of the thought is, which is a critical teaching. It's foundational to all Buddhist teaching, which is that he's looking at cause and effect. And this is goes beyond just this sutta and these particular ideas, that besides looking at what's in our mind, if we can see what the result of those thoughts is, then we start to put together how we create our reality, how we create our experience. And then we have the opportunity, we have some agency in our own lives because I'm seeing what's going on and I'm seeing how it's playing out. And then if, I can develop strategies for working with that. Whereas the ordinary unexamined mind just does what it does and churns out thoughts and churns out opinions and churns out views and impulses, and then we act on them and create our lives. And then we go, why is my life like this? How come I have all these problems? Because we're not seeing that the root of it is occurring in the mind with these thoughts. So he's seeing the causal relationship between, in this case, thoughts of sensual desire and the pain that it causes to himself and to others. And then he says, when I considered this, that it leads to all this affliction, it subsided in me. So this is like when we just have a moment of clarity, like, what am I doing? Like, I don't need to think this. This isn't helpful. And so if we put it in terms of addiction, the thought of sensual desire, the thought of craving, and you think, man, a nice cold beer would taste really good right now. And then you realize, what am I don't drink. alcohol is a killer for me. No. And for those of us who have been fortunate to have that craving removed, the thought arises, and then we see it and we're like, we lose interest in it. It subsides, right? Now, that's an ideal. It doesn't always work that way. But you'll see this again, to correlate your own meditative experience with what you read. Notice if this happens for you, that when you're meditating and you find yourself like generating something, one of these three unwholesome things, sensual desire, ill will, and cruelty. I mean, that's sort of certain categories, but that we have all kinds of, variations on those things. But when you see it, does it just stop? And I would say that from my experience is that sometimes yes, and sometimes no. And interestingly, the next sutta, which I'm not going to go into, but the next sutta, another one that many of you have encountered, is called the removal of distracting thoughts. And it essentially addresses the things that don't just subside when you see them, as this sutta says. And it gives you these more aggressive strategies for removing them, or more specific strategies. So here, in the two kinds of thought, the way the sutta plays out, the Buddha goes through these three categories of unwholesome thought. And for each one, he says, when it is arisen in me, I see the affliction it causes to me, to others, and to both. And then when I see that, it subsides in me. And the same is true for thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty. And then he delivers what is mentioned as the best-known line from this sutta, and really one that sums up a lot of his teaching. Whatever, I'm just going to put it in generic language. This is directed towards the monks, but I'll just say, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. If one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, they have abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate sensual desire, and so on with ill will and thoughts of cruelty. Whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. That's a good line to memorize, because it captures so much of what this practice is about. And again, it is talking about cause and effect. This is the law of karma that's at the heart of Buddhist teachings. If I keep thinking about that stuff, I'm just going to get obsessed with it. And this again is right in there with addiction. This is what happens with addiction. And I would add, which it's interesting that he doesn't say this in this sutta, though it's implied in many of his teachings, whatever one frequently does, that becomes the inclination of your actions, of your behaviors, of your body, we could say, if we're just talking about, the mind and the body. And that's equally important, right? Whatever one frequently acts upon, that becomes our habitual behavior. So this is exactly, he's talking here about addiction, about mental addiction, about physical addiction, about the habit patterns that we develop through repeated action. And, we can go back to, for each of us, we can reflect on, well, what got me there? For example, you might have had your first drink and liked the way that felt. And so you did it again. And then you started to, drink whenever you could. And then it goes from a choice into a habit and finally into an addiction through this repeated behavior. And you wind up thinking and pondering upon it all the time, right? You're thinking about the next time you're going to get drunk. I mean, that's what happened to me certainly as a teenager. I remember, one of my first jobs after I dropped out of high school was mowing the lawn in the cemetery up the street from my house, the Niskie Hill Cemetery, where some of my relatives are buried. And calculating as I pushed the lawnmower, because this was a push lawnmower, how much alcohol I'd be able to buy based on how many hours I was working, So that was like frequently thinking and pondering upon alcohol becomes the inclination of the mind. But we can't, I think, remind ourselves of this important teaching too often. It's so useful. Like, what am I thinking about? Why? And if you ever wonder why some thought keeps appearing in your mind, realize that you've spent a lot of time unconsciously thinking about it. It's like you go on a retreat and all of a sudden all these songs start playing in your mind. I mean, this is what happens to me. It's like, oh, because I've been listening to a lot of music. I mean, it's not complicated. Okay, so now there are two similes, critical kind of. There's actually three similes, but there's two similes regarding this topic in this sutta. So I'm going to read this first one. Just as in the last month of the rainy season in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he let them stray into the crops. So too, I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So again, the language is quite, lofty, degradation, defilement, renunciation. But the point is to get the image that you've got a cowherd who is, well, it's the last month of the rainy season. The crops are almost ready to be harvested. And you've got these cows, and if they go into the field and start trampling the crops, you get into trouble. And I will note that there appeared not to be any OSHA back then, because you could get flogged, imprisoned, or fined if you just let the cows go into the crops. In any case, he's very careful, right? The cowherd. He's like, stay out of the crops. He's like just standing with the cows, tapping them with the stick. No, don't go over there. No, don't go over there. Stay out of those crops, because I'm going to get in trouble. So this is when the mind is kind of, shaky, when we're meditating, but we're having a hard time staying focused. The mind keeps jumping away, or it keeps going into unwholesome, unhelpful thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of cruelty, thoughts of ill will. So when we realize I'm meditating and I realize, oh, I'm kind of in one of these places where I need to make a little bit more effort. I need to kind of stay on top of it. That's the image here. You're going to be very careful in your meditation. So then that's kind of laying out the setting for the unwholesome. Then the Buddha switches to the wholesome. He says, as I abided diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. So a thought of letting go. And then a thought of non-ill will, non-cruelty. So now he's having wholesome thoughts. And he says, with those, he doesn't have to be so protective, so careful. So he has a different. He goes through. Much of the same, he repeats just in this flip side, much of the same teaching in regard to this, including whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. If one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, they have abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate thoughts of renunciation. Then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. So, I mean, it's simple and maybe simplistic in a way, because, you know, our minds aren't quite so mechanical that we could just, I'll just think about this. But this is kind of why we do things like loving kindness meditation, or, you know, develop some, like, you know, common things that we say to ourselves to get ourselves out of a bad mood, or out of, you know, some unhelpful thinking, like, oh, it's okay, just chill, just breathe. You know, I don't know what you guys say, but, you know, I have various things that I say to myself at times, so that, and that's one of the reasons why we practice something like loving kindness and repeat phrases of loving kindness, so that what arises in the mind more instinctively is a wholesome thought, when we might be inclined to think something unwholesome. And it's why we reflect on something like impermanence, you know, that, you know, when something ends, someone passes away, or something breaks, or you lose a job or something, not that we just go, oh, well, everything's impermanent, but that you remember that to get yourself, keep yourself in some degree of balance. So that's just, you know, offhand a couple thoughts about how to frequently think and ponder upon wholesome thoughts. So then the Buddha gives his counter simile. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was no need for me to only to be mindful that those states were there. So I think of this, again, trying to correlate my own meditative experience. When things settle a little bit in the mind, that you, rather than being like, oh, I'm going to really watch every element of the breath in, out, I'm going to open the mind a little bit and be more open to feel the body and just notice thoughts are coming and going. There's nothing really disruptive, you know, and we sit in a kind of what we talk about as a spacious mind. And so that's, this simile very much captures that. Now, instead of being right on top of the cows, tapping them, keeping them out of the crops, he's sitting back under the root of a tree, just relaxing, watching the cows are over there. It's like, okay, there's no problem. There's no crops. They're not going to do any harm. They're just going around chewing on things. I got an eye on them. So it's a great, I love this sutta for the similes, and for all these elements of it are so really useful and evocative for meditators, that really capture a lot of elements of our practice. There's quite a bit more in the sutta that we could go into some of the details, but these are to me the most important elements of this sutta. First of all, to watch the mind and see what types of things are in the mind, and then based upon your mental state, in other words, making the choice to either be more assertive with your effort, more directive, of staying right on top of the breath, in, out, or more spacious, if the mind isn't inclined towards something unwholesome. Yeah, so I guess there's a question here, huh? I see there's something in the blah, 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 blah. Sorry. Central, oh, sensual, yes, sensual pleasure. Sorry if I didn't pronounce well. This is one, I was thinking about this recently when I was teaching on Zoom, and somebody said something, what are they talking about? It's one of the frustrations of this, much as we're fortunate to have have a way to meet without having to all fly into Berkeley. It's also not the ideal form of communication. Yes, so sensual desire. So sensual desire, I mean, oftentimes when the Buddha, as in this sutta, is talking to monks, he's talking about sex, He's saying, like, because that's what obsesses the mind of a celibate monk, as one, one would expect. These are like young men, celibate, and so he's trying to. There's a lot of teachings where he's trying to help them to not get all wrapped up in being lustful. However, the point. It certainly means more than that. Certainly the craving for alcohol or drugs is a sensual desire. The craving for sugar, for food, the craving for warm weather or cooler weather or more comfortable clothing and on and on and on, that we could just say the craving for material objects is a form of sensual desire. The craving for beauty, excuse me. I want to hear some music. That's a craving for, that's a sensual desire. And not to make this too much of a, we're not. It's really important when we start to talk about this stuff that we're not moralizing about sensual desire. We're not saying that there's something bad about wanting a cookie, We know, I assume people here are in recovery from some kind of substance abuse. Maybe it's something else you're in recovery from, but let's just say in substance abuse, we know the danger and the harm that comes from addictive craving. And, the Buddha on this more subtle level points out that, yeah, even the craving for, music, that if you reflect on the craving itself, it's uncomfortable. It's dukkha. But he's not saying it's bad to want a cookie or to want music, He's saying be aware of the suffering that's caused. And yeah, in if you're a monastic, then you limit even further your behavior. But for lay people, we don't put those limits, we don't have to be celibate. We don't have to just eat one meal a day or, the various rules. But the invitation ultimately is just to examine our lives and see what's bringing happiness, what's bringing peace, and what's bringing agitation and mental discomfort. So, this is the really the spirit of Buddhism is that it's not about morality, it's about suffering and ending suffering. And it turns out that immorality, if we can say that, often causes suffering. But we're not saying that that means you're a bad person or that you're going to go to hell, although there is a hell in classical Buddhism, but or there are hells. But really about looking honestly at your life, at your mind, at your behavior, and seeing what's leading to happiness and what's leading away from happiness. And this again, for me, works so much, correlates perfectly with addiction. I don't think I was a bad person because I was drinking and using, but I certainly caused affliction for myself and for others. And at the end of the day, I stopped that because of that, not because I was trying to be good, and not commit sins or something, but because it was painful. Well, geez, I almost used up all the time. I didn't mean to do that. But I'm hanging out, so I'll take a question or a couple questions. We can run over. I know some people will have to leave. Some people already have left. Not that I'm counting the participants, but I am counting the participants. Okay. Any questions, any comments, reflections? Well, that must mean that I covered everything and answered all the questions. John, were you trying to raise your hand there? No, you're just okay. Did I say three similes? Yes, there's a third simile that I did not go into. It's sort of odd. I mean, but it doesn't really match up with the rest of the sutta. So, but you look at Majjhima Nikaya 19, you can find it online, and you can see the sutta, the simile. Yeah. Well, I'm going to be leaving for Big Bear tomorrow, teaching Thursday through Monday, and then I'll be in LA on Monday. And or Tuesday at my nephew's place in Glendale, actually. So that's where I anticipate my next teaching to be from. When you see me, it will presumably be a different background unless something else happens. So appreciate people showing up. Oh yeah, Deborah, you're coming down to Big Bear, right? Good. So, hope to see people then. Anybody who wants to come to Big Bear, it's probably too late, but you could always give it a shot. All right. Be well. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Thanks, Mike.